as we saw Federer's greatness emerge, and he was this bridge from the past game into the present game, and he was able to look like he was playing a game 100 years ago, but played at twice as fast as it had been played. His one-handed slice backhand and his ability to bring people into no man's land, right? That, how uncomfortable is it for two-handed backhands like yours and mine to have to come forward and be in that awkward spot where you're not sure if you should come to the net or you should go back? And he was brilliant at putting people like Andy Roddick, who was a great grass court player, in that awkward position and kind of having his way with them from there. He was coaching Federer when Federer lost to Nadal at that Roland Garros. After that match, Jose was sitting in his hotel room in Paris. He was so depressed because it had gone so one-sidedly for Rafa. And the phone rings, and it's Roger. And Roger goes, "Pepe," which is Jose's nickname, "where are you?" And he goes, "Hey, Roger, I'm just in my hotel room." He goes, "Pepe, we're downstairs. We got a party. You got to come down." Roger has always had this incredible lightness of being, and that's just further evidence to how he was able to manage those moments, is that he didn't put a lot of stock in him. He knew that he was great and that he'd have other chances.
All right, welcome to another edition of the Tennis Worthy Podcast, brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I am Patrick McEnroe, the president of the Hall of Fame, and it's pretty rare that we get, first of all, it's rare that I'm actually in the Wimbledon studio here, and Jim Courier, who's going to join me, is here at Wimbledon as well at his beautiful hotel, which is the same hotel where I stay at. But it's pretty rare that we get the opportunity to talk to not only a Hall of Famer, but a former world number one about another Hall of Famer and another former world number one. And that's the treat we have for you today here on the podcast. Jim, welcome. We appreciate you doing this for the Hall of Fame. Good to see you.
Patrick, always good to be with you. I don't get to speak with the president of anything very often, so to get a chance to spend some time with the president of the Hall of Fame is a real treat for me.
Well, we love having you here, and we're looking forward to what's happening at the end of the summer. I know you're going to be part of that too, the celebration, the induction of the great Roger Federer into the Hall of Fame. All right, we're here at Wimbledon. This is a place where Roger dominated for so long. Give me Jim Courier's first memory of seeing Roger Federer on grass.
So, when I was leaving the tour, Roger was just starting to come in. I was in tournament draws with him, but I was never in a Wimbledon draw with him because I retired in 2000 prior to Wimbledon. So, but I was starting to work in television there. So I was at those first Wimbledons when Roger was just getting going. And of course, I was lucky enough to be there when he and Pete Sampras met at Wimbledon. And that was a monumental match. That was a match that so many of us refer back to when we have these moments where you see these young players topple the legends of the game. I think of Fonseca recently beating Djokovic at Roland Garros. And it's just a touchstone moment that I think a lot of us refer back to give a little context to, because that was the coming out party for Roger Federer. Sampras was still a great champion, and he would go on to win the U.S. Open again for his last major. But he was second best on that day against Federer. And you could start to see Federer put all of his assets into play, and what a great grass court champion he will become. You could see sort of the beginnings of the butterfly wing starting to come out that day.
Yeah, I remember, I called the first final that he won. It was on NBC, so we at ESPN had the rights during the week. So they said, well, we should call this just in case. You know, it's a great match, right, for ESPN Classic, because NBC was doing it live. So Cliff Drysdale, you know, my mentor in so many ways, I know you love Cliffy, who's also a Hall of Famer, by the way, as a contributor, who was my mentor in television, and I worked with him for so many years. We called that match when he beat Philippoussis for his first Wimbledon. And I'll never forget it, and it still gets me a little emotional to think about it because, you know, I know Cliff so well. Cliff had tears in his eyes, Jim, when Federer, you know, went down to his knees. And as sort of the ceremony was happening or starting to happen, you know, we took a little break and I said, geez, Cliff, I said, you know, are you okay? What's more? He says, it was for him, you know, having been an old school guy, having played against Laver and Rosewall and the rest, you know, he could tell that he knew that this guy was something extra special. Like it was like the first time for all of us to see him in some way. So for me, that was a watershed moment like you're talking about. But he didn't win it that year when he beat Sampras. I think it was Henman, our buddy Tim Henman beat him. But I want to ask you about this, because before we get into, you know, other specific matches from Roger, what about the grass and how it changed? Because you were in a final when you were just 22. By the way, you were the youngest guy to make all four major finals until that Alcaraz guy did it this year at the Australian Open. So, but the difference in the grass back when you played, and you were a baseliner, so I'm assuming it's even more difficult for you. You probably watching today said, God, I wish I could play on this grass. How different was it then to what it is now, and how hard or easy was it for you to adapt to it?
Sure. So they made the change to a different type of grass composition in the early 2000s, and that's allowed the grass to be firmer and play with a higher bounce than we experienced, Patrick. And I don't know if you had to make adjustments to your game as much as I did. You were a little bit more adept coming forward than I was, but I had to serve and volley first and second serve a lot, and that was something that was not natural to me. And I think most of the baseline players of that, of any time really, until 2000, felt the need to do that. And it was such a different surface that I often tell this to people who ask, well, how did it change? Well, players have rituals. And my ritual was to bounce the ball before I hit a first serve. I do 3 2 bounce sequences. So 6 bounces in total, as I thought about what I was going to do with my first couple shots in the rally. The grass court was so spongy, and it was such an effort to get the ball to bounce back up to me that I had to modify even the bounce before I served. That's how different it was. It couldn't bounce up, and I got frustrated with it. So I went to far fewer bounces in advance of that. So you didn't have the options to stay back and rally. It's still difficult to move on the surface. That piece of the puzzle hasn't changed. But the fact that the ball is hit at waist height a lot more these days than it used to be is the biggest difference in why. And Roger Federer was a big reason why I think a lot of players started playing more from the baseline, because I think as we saw Federer's greatness emerge, and he was this bridge from the past game into the present game, and he was able to look like he was playing a game 100 years ago, but played at twice as fast as it had been played. You saw that Federer stopped serving volleying over the course of his incredible run at Wimbledon, right? And if Roger Federer can't be successful, or at least if he thinks he can't be as successful serving and volleying as he is at the baseline, then who else is going to serve and volley? So I think that's why you'll see on your Wimbledon telecast when you're in the finals this year that there won't be that pathway to the net that was worn brown by the likes of the greats who played in years before.
Yeah, I used to do the same thing. I remember one year I stopped bouncing the ball at all because it was so annoying. Like, you'd have to throw it down so hard. I wish I had your serve, but that's another story. All right, let's talk about Roger. And why do you think, Jim Courier, that Roger Federer made grass look so easy? Because like you said, it's a surface that, you know, we don't play on much. You only play for it these couple weeks of the year. How and why was he able to make it look so effortless?
Well, I think we start with the movement, which is the biggest challenge and the biggest difference between the clay and the hard courts, where you can really go hard into the corners and to play defense and hit the brakes and come back into position. Federer has a very light touch with his feet. And the fact that he was able to take those little steps and effortlessly stay on balance when so many players slip and fall. I mean, he wasn't immune to that, but he did it less than most, I would say. And then you factor in that he has every shot in the book. And it wasn't a question of did he have the shots? It was early on in his career what to do with all those options. And once he figured out how to manage all those great options and which card to play when, it all started to click for him. And I think naturally his one-handed slice backhand and his ability to bring people into no man's land, right? That, how uncomfortable is it for two-handed backhands like yours and mine to have to come forward and be in that awkward spot where you're not sure if you should come to the net or you should go back? And he was brilliant at putting people like Andy Roddick, who was a great grass court player, in that awkward position and kind of having his way with them from there. What do you think?
You know, we know that Federer was arguably the greatest offensive player. You could maybe argue Pete was up there with him too, because his serve was bigger. Maybe the forehand was bigger. Roger had a little more variety to his game. But what I always marveled at watching him play on grass was how he could use, you talked about that slice, how he could use that slice as a defensive weapon. You talked about it being an offensive shot. He could play it short, but he was able to keep himself in so many points using that slice backhand on the run. And I think that's really an underrated part of his game, particularly on grass. Would you agree?
Oh, I totally agree with it. You think about where you don't want to hit it to Roger's forehand. You're trying to avoid that shot. But yet on a grass court, he could hurt you arguably just as much with a low slice backhand, because then you're hitting the ball off of your knee tops instead of your hip level. And that means you've got to hit the ball up and over the net and give it a little more shape And that's when he would kind of hit that beautiful slice backhand from his backhand corner. You think you've got him. And then he's hanging in that backhand corner. You hit something that doesn't have enough on it. And then he smacks the forehand and the point's gone. So his ability to change the energy of a point, it's different than what Novak has been able to do with his sliding two-handed backhand and his open stance two-handed backhand. That's a different type of offensive defense, if you will. But Federer with the classic slice backhand could just mute the power players.
Yeah, and Federer had so many weapons. I mean, the serve was tremendous. Not necessarily the speed, but the direction. He could change up the pace and
accuracy.
The kick or the slice. Yeah, the accuracy. But the other thing about his game, and this was, you know, similar to what you did and what, you know, Lendl sort of started, was the serve plus one, the serve plus the big forehand. You kind of took that up a notch with your big inside-out forehand. Roger was able to hit that shot, but also, you know, I always marvel that way. You pull the guy cross court and then anticipate that next one coming back to his forehand and take that ball so early and put it up the line.
Oh,
so do you think he took that forehand, like sort of that type of play, to a whole nother level?
There's no question that he did, Patrick. There's no question that he was a time thief. One of his great skills was taking time away from his opponents, doing exactly what you're describing. Taking the plus one shot and then being ready for a weak response and not sitting back on the baseline. He was already two steps inside the baseline, hitting that forehand on the rise. And if he had to hit a volley, he was going to be that much closer to the net. So not a lot of players have that naturally. Tsitsipas at his apex, I thought, has been really good at doing that. And I hope he gets back to that. Again, using his forehand to take time away from people. Alcaraz clearly is unbelievably gifted at that, just innately. And then we've seen players like Sinner really develop that ability to hug the baseline and do exactly that. But Roger, I think, was the first one, I think, to show all of us what was possible with your anticipation combined with great skill.
I was listening to one of his interviews in one of the years. I think he probably won it 4 or 5 times. And I was walking around the village. I had my headsets on. I was listening to his post-match interview, and he said something to the effect of, and you brought it up a little bit earlier, yeah, you know, like they were sort of saying, like, what else could you do? Because you're so dominant at Wimbledon. He said, yeah, I think I'd like to win it serving and volleying 1 year. Now, he never actually did that, but it was funny to hear him say, yeah, maybe I'll just try serving and volleying. But that never really happened. But what other matches do you remember? I mean, there's the obvious one when Rafa finally got him and beat him in that final. But what other sort of moments for you step out in the great history of Roger Federer here at Wimbledon?
Well, I think of that match when Andy Roddick played virtually the perfect match against him. And Federer was somehow able to fend off all the chances that Andy was able to generate. And Andy hit one volley that it's probably the only shot that you could say, man, that one was regrettable. Everything else, Andy played virtually a perfect match. And I can commiserate with that because I felt like I played that level match when I lost my one final that I was able to play at Wimbledon to Sampras. I don't think I could have played better, and it still wasn't quite good enough just because Pete was simply better than I was. Certainly on a grass court, there was even a wider gulf. So I think about how Federer was able to mentally withstand the barrage and the pressure of trying to hold when he had to work a little bit harder with his serve. He had to be more precise with his serve because he didn't have the innate power. That was a magical match, wasn't it?
If I remember correctly, I believe Federer ended up with actually more aces than Roddick in that match. But
he almost always did in those matches,
yeah,
which is weird.
It was weird because he was the guy. I mean, we talk about the great returners, right? You know, Djokovic obviously at the top of that list now. But Federer too, especially on grass, because of that length and because of that anticipation, it was very difficult to ace him, and that was part of his success. Do you think that was just his physical ability? I mean, obviously that's huge, but do you think that, like, he picked things up differently, or is he just kind of more of a reactive type of returner?
Well, I think that his ability to block off of both sides was a big key. So he was able to basically hit volleys from the baseline off of returns using the power of someone like Roddick serve against him in a way, and just especially on the backhand side, but even the forehand. But he also, I don't know if his arms are longer. Like, I've never asked him what his suit length is. He might have longer arms the way that it looks like
Sinner does. It kind of looks like he does. I think he does.
Yeah. And Pete certainly did and does. And that's an advantage too. Like, you got that extra Stretch Armstrong vibe of being able to get your racket on more shots and then just have amazing racket control and ball control. And then once you're in the rally with him, you would feel the pressure, no doubt, of what he could do. But yeah, his serve, along with Sampras's, I think, of the two most accurate serves that I've ever seen across their careers. And I think the second half of Novak's career, he's matched them on accuracy. So they don't have to be the biggest serves, and those aren't the biggest serves even of their time, but they're the best and most effective because of that accuracy component and how much they make them under pressure.
No one better than you at breaking down the tactics and the technique of players that we've heard you over the years on Tennis Channel, on TNT, down on Channel 9 in Australia. But I want to ask you this about Roger. Do you think he was actually moving faster than anyone else, or was he just getting there earlier?
Getting there earlier. I don't think that Roger would necessarily have won, let's say, like a 40-meter race or a 100-meter race against someone like a Gael Monfils. I think Monfils gets him in that. But he had incredible anticipation and great agility, too. And agility, as we all know, that's kind of the whole enchilada in tennis, because you don't run 100 meters straight. You might run... You know, it might run 10 to 15 meters at the most if you're running from, you know, corner to a drop shot. But I think the ability to hit the brakes, Roger had sneaky strong legs, still does, right? But his quads were monstrous. But because of the longer shorts, you didn't really notice that unless you got up close to him, like we're lucky enough to do, you know, working and talking to him after matches. But that leg strength, he had the ability to get in and out of the corners, break and get back into position. And then that innate ability to feel where you were going before you knew it. I think he was pretty preternatural at that.
Yeah, you were one of the guys in the men's game that took the fitness to another level, right? With your work ethic and all the things you did off the court, the off court training, the dedication. Roger, I think we learned that you and I did, people like you said that are close to him, but he kind of kept that pretty quiet. I mean, late in his career, he started to reveal a few more things about the stuff he did. But Pierre Paganini, who was his longtime fitness trainer, you had one yourself that I know was very important to you. How important and how undervalued, but the casual fan doesn't know about that as much as maybe they should. Talk a little bit about what Roger did to keep himself in tip-top shape and still play into his late 30s.
Yeah, he did a great job of keeping a lot of what he was doing off-court secret. And he and Stan Wawrinka used Pierre Paganini, and both of them have had, you know, marvelous long careers. And I think what we've learned is that Federer did a lot of things to keep it fresh and fun too. And I think that's a part of it also. Like you never question whether he was prepared. You never question whether he was ready. I think a lot of us would just question, well, how can he keep going like this? I mean, how long can you go stay healthy? The game is more ballistic than it's ever been. The change of direction is faster than it's ever been. And yet here he goes. He's still going on until finally his knee got him. But, you know, Roger had that. He is a magical athlete. There's no doubt about it. And he was born with innate skills, but they were highly honed and developed. And that's the thing that, you know, you and I both remember Pat Etcheberry, who passed away recently. Yep. He was my strength and conditioning coach through the bulk of my career and changed my career. He also was Pete Sampras's when Pete and I were both young. So people think that Pete, because he made it look so easy, didn't work hard. And there are a lot of parallels between Roger and Pete. They worked extremely hard. You just didn't get to see the work because they were real casual when they came to the courts for the tournaments. So the public didn't see it. And even a lot of the players didn't see it. But if you got to train alongside, I'm sure Stan Wawrinka would be able to tell us how hard Roger worked.
You know, the other person I want to mention who unfortunately just recently passed away is a great Jim Lehrer, who I did multiple podcasts with for the Tennis Hall of Fame, Jim, including one as maybe 6 months ago. And he always spoke so highly of you. I know you feel the same way about him. So I just want to give him and his family a shout out because he was one of the class acts in tennis and helping with the mental side. But let's talk about that mental side with Roger, because I think for me, one of the things that stood out about him and his career, you know, I hearken back to when he just got destroyed by Rafa in the French Open final, when he won like 3 or 4 games of that one final. And then that was the year that was that the year Rafa beat him at Wimbledon, or was it next year? I can't remember. But anyway, my point is, it might have been 08. But what my point is that I marvel at these, especially these three guys that were able to put some of these losses behind them, right? And still keep going. And Roger had that ability, didn't he, to just kind of, you know, take the wins, but also be able to sort of let those losses go by the, we always say, well, you know, forget about that. But, it, you know, it's harder to do that when you're actually out there on the tour. You know that.
Well, let's talk about our great friend, Jose Higueras, who worked alongside you at the USTA for many years. He was part of the team that helped me become someone that you'd want to talk to today. He's an amazing insight. He was coaching Federer when Federer lost to Nadal at that Roland Garros. What we would later learn is that Federer at that time was suffering from mononucleosis. So he was his body was depleted, but his mind and his spirit never got depleted. And Jose told me one time that after that match, Jose was sitting in his hotel room in Paris. He was so depressed because it had gone so one-sidedly for Rafa. And the phone rings and it's Roger. And Roger goes, Pepe, which is Jose's nickname, where are you? And he goes, hey, Roger, I'm just in my hotel room. He goes, Pepe, we're downstairs. We got a party. You got to come down. And he goes downstairs and it's all of you know, Team Federer and their friends and
his
family.
Yeah.
And they're celebrating a Roland Garros job well done, even though the final didn't go his way. Roger has always had this incredible lightness of being. And that's just further evidence to how he was able to manage those moments is that he didn't put a lot of stock in him. He knew that he was great and that he'd have other chances.
Well, you are one of the all-time greats. And as you said, Pete Sampras, your great rival, certainly one of the all-time greats, especially at Wimbledon. So I got to ask you this. Coming.
By the way, are we going to get Pete in Newport to celebrate Rogers?
I'm working on it. I could use
your
help.
We need Pistol to show up. Yeah, that would be great.
We want him to be there. We'd love him to be there. So I'm still working on that. Pete against Roger.
Mm-hmm.
In their prime. Playing at the top of their game on grass at Wimbledon, who wins?
We might have a 70-68. It might be a Isner Mahut type match if we didn't have the match tiebreak, because it's hard to see much of a difference in the gap between them. Listen, Federer had a more complete game than Pete because his topspin backhand was better. It was more consistent. But you and I both experienced firsthand how clutch Pete was as a player. I've never seen a player be that clutch. You look at Pete's record in major finals, he's 14-4, but the bulk of the finals he lost were late in his career. He just was so good at finishing people off, and he played in an era that had some quality players in it. So I don't know that I'd be able to put a compass pointing to one direction or another. I think it would have just been so close. I think on a slower surface, I think I probably would have given Roger a little bit more of an edge because I think his backhand would have been able to neutralize a bit more than Pete's could. But I don't know. What do you think?
I think if they were playing in the same court that you played Sampras on in the Wimbledon final, believe it or not, I'd give the slight edge to Pete.
I don't disagree with that because we have evidence that Pete could serve in volley first and second and win.
And I think Pete never said that. Yeah, and I think it would come down to, as you were just saying, a couple of points. And I could just see Pete coming up with like one unbelievable, you know, forehand pass, or, you know, backhand return. You know, he missed like the whole set. He'd miss them all.
All
then
set.
He'd hit one, a couple, of, right. You know, 5-6 in the set.
Yep.
But I do think that if it were the post-2001 grass, as it's evolved, as you talked about, I do think that Roger would get into more of Pete's service games and likely he would win. So I always use that little caveat, you know, depends on the grass that they're playing on, but that would be something.
Would have loved to have seen it.
Well, loved to have seen them both in their prime. Would have been amazing. All right, as we get ready to wrap this up, you know, why do you think Roger Federer, I mean, you know that you sold out this thing in 2 minutes. You know, the interest in coming to Newport we've never seen anything like it, at least that I know about. Maybe when you went in, it was pretty high. I'm sure it was up there. But no, you know what I'm saying. This is like another level. So why do you think Federer is so even more popular now than when he was playing?
So many athletes, you know, they'll do a few things over the course of their career because being at the pinnacle of sport, it comes with the highest of highs and the lowest of lows. And sometimes people aren't as graceful when they have those low moments as they'd like to be. And sometimes fans will see that and they might just put a little check mark against them. And Federer's really never put a foot wrong. He's had low moments. And if he's had any kind of reaction to them, they've been out of sight from the public. And he's always been a very gracious loser. Right. I mean, I could say he's actually a worse winner than he is right. a gracious loser, because he's so matter of fact about it. It all just makes sense that he's winning because he's just so damn good. So, you know, he says things, and maybe it's a language barrier where it can, for some people, might come across as a little bit arrogant. But for him, he's just stating the facts, and it's hard to argue that that's not the case given his amazing record. But I think there's just that, again, that natural lightness of being and the grace that he handled the years at the throne, and then all the challengers that came for him that turned out to be amazing players. He handled it all with such dignity. And it's kind of one of those feelings, I think most people would go, gosh, I would love for Roger to be a part of my family. That's the kind of person I want to be around. And I think we all feel that way about Roger. He's handled it all with such class. And he continues to handle the aftermath of his career as a great ambassador for the sport. You can see how much he genuinely loves the sport and loves to be around it. When he gets a chance, he brings his family around. Like, there's a real connection, I think, that we all still feel with Roger in a way that someone like an Arnold Palmer had with golfers and Jack Nicklaus, you know, where you just feel like this guy's the fabric of the sport in a sense.
It represents so all the stuff that's good about the sport and all, you know, the sportsmanship, the class, as you said, the dignity. All right, before I let you go, give me one word to describe Roger Federer on grass.
On grass, majestic. I think majestic is a good word. What about you?
I love
what
that.
Do you got for
no,
me?
No, you get the last word, man. You're JC, okay. As we call you, the Rock, a Hall of Famer, four-time major champion. We will see you, Jim, at the induction ceremony. Looking forward to that. And we appreciate you joining us here on the Tennis Worthy Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Mr. President.
Jim Currier here on Tennis Worthy.